Good morning. Our learning this morning is sponsored by Bill and Leah Nissel and Sandy Nissel Horowitz, and Norman Horowitz in memory of Bill and Sandy's father, Sol Nissel, Shlomo Meir, Ben Reb Chaim, Leib Adriel, Olive HaShalom. Oh, Shalom should have an Aliyah. Also sponsored by Jack and Ruthie Reisner in memory of Ruth's father, Judah Weinfeld, Yehuda Ben Yosef Chaim Alevi, Olive HaShalom, and Shalom have Aliyot. Our learning will be in their memory. May their memory continue to be a blessing. We daf chaf aleph, and I feel a sense of deep ease today because we're starting halfway down the Amud. We're going to go over to chaf aleph Amud Bet, about four lines up from the bottom. And this is a relatively smooth journey for us today. And I regret this every time at YU when I take to the students. We're probably going to finish early today because I've finished 2 minutes early is my record so far at YU. So I'm going to say I think we'll finish early today, but... you don't believe me anyway, so it doesn't matter. So we're on to the third parak. The first two we said, if we were to try to boil it down to a single theme, which is of course somewhat superficial, but generally we'd say, oh, thank you, David. We'd say the first chapter was about the necessity of hope. And the premise of Megillah, you're a people in exile. That's the idea of Megillat Esther. This is the only story that unfolds in the diaspora. This is included in Tanakh. How do you sustain a people without a territorial home? The first chapter was about the necessity of hope. You have to repeat stories of potential redemption, keep hope alive. And you've got to feed the flame of faith. And we said that was basically the beginning of Megillah, was Ahasuerus saying the 70 years are up, they were promised, they're not going back. It's over, let them assimilate and join us. And that what led to this whole chain of events that threatened and imperiled the entire Jewish people. So that was the first chapter. The second chapter that we just finished off last week was dedicated to the medium of memory. And I confess that may be me leaning into an alliteration over precision. But it was about, now that we've said you need hope, what is the ideal way to inject that hope into a people? We said you need the story to be said in an order. You can't just download bits of information, willy-nilly, chapter 5, chapter 2, chapter 1. You should progress stories, human beings process information in narrative form. And so it needs to be read in order. Then we spoke about who the speaker should be. Is it somebody who can absorb what they're saying, the message they're giving? We said memory is more compelling to an audience if it is being channeled through a figure who themselves is absorbing the story. It involves more charisma and it's more compelling. And we spoke about the language being important as well. If it's in Hebrew and you don't understand, that's okay. And if it's in Greek you don't understand, it might be okay to wander Ushim by Yochai, if I remember correctly. But other languages, it has to be understood by the audience, but what you're participating in, perpetuating together, doesn't have to be intellectually absorbed at the same time. It could just be, I recognize and I'm forming a memory that I can hand on. That's chapter 2. Chapter 3 is, I'm still looking for an alliteration, but I guess the atmospherics of attention will work for us. And I was trying to think about an easy parallel, and I just thought about my last week, everyone in the house has got a flu of some sort. We're dealing with medicine. You've got 14 different medicines going on. And you can, in theory, say not having a flu is good for your health. That's step one. Step two is the scientist has to concoct the right medicine that will ideally deal with the flu. The third stage is, how do I get the kid to drink it? And that can sometimes be the most complicated part. And I can't tell you all the deals and the jelly bellies and the treats and the videos that were engaged in that third process today. So that, Lahavdil, is we've said Chazal are diagnosing hopelessness is bad for the body politic. In the diaspora, it will lead to decay. So we've diagnosed the problem. Hopelessness is a problem. Then we said, okay, so what's the concoction to inject hope? And we've said, you've got to say it in an order. You have to have a good representation to convey the medium. You have to use the right language. And we spoke about more details along that. That's the scientific concoction, the medicine. Now, third chapter, how do we get the people to take it? What is the right way? Now that we've established how to, the medium for conveying memory, how do you make sure people pay attention? Now, of course, if you're in a body politic where you've got armed forces and you've got a morality police, you can say, get into shul, sit down, and we're going to bang the bimbo. We're going to stop every time no one's listening. However, and that works to some degree, and of course shuls do that now. If people aren't listening or talking and paying attention, sometimes you've got different attitudes among the gabayim and the rabbi or the lay leadership. How do you get decorum? But in theory, you know, if you made it very harsh and uncompelling, what would happen? If a shul became a place where you said, if you talk, we're going to stare at you and we're going to put signs up, what could happen to the shul membership?
Stay home.
Yes, I don't need this. You know, I've come to see my friend. I'm going to go to their house and you know, forget you. And you just, you know, you do what you want and I'm going to go somewhere else. So this third chapter is devoted to how do we calibrate attentiveness in a way that is not alienating, but also gives a sense that this is serious and there is sobriety involved in what we're doing. So this is where we're going to start shifting from reading the Megillah to reading the Torah, reading Haftorah, and how do we ensure that the public are absorbing the messages? If you've got the right medium, but no one's paying attention, it doesn't help. So that's what we're going to go. And then the fourth chapter, we'll talk about the laws of the Bet Knesset generally, which is kind of theme that bridges on from this. And we've got four daf on this chapter. So let's do the Mishnah, and then we'll power through. Hakarat Megillah, Omed V'Yoshev. You read the Megillah, you can sit or stand. So traditionally, we assume the person reading the Megillah is standing. Technically, it seems sitting is perfectly fine as well. Kara echad, kara shnayim yatsu. One person can read it, even two people can read it. Meaning you could have a harmony. You could have two readers of the Megillah at the Bema reading the Megillah together, and that's fine. Now the Gemara is going to assume from here there's an implication. Reading the Megillah this way is fine, but, bless you, reading the Torah is not fine this way. There's an exclusion that reading the Torah, you can't do it sitting, and you can't do it as a harmony, but the Megillah can. In a place where you say a bracha on the Megillah, you should say the bracha. In a place you don't say the bracha, you don't say the bracha. There seems to be some flexibility. So what we're getting in terms of Megillah reading, a huge amount of flexibility. You can be sitting or standing. You can have a harmony, not a harmony. You don't. If you say a bracha, you say a bracha. If you don't, you don't. That's what it sounds like initially. And now we start going to how else do we generate attention when we're trying to get the group to focus? B'shein v'chamishi b'shabbat mincha. When we've got Monday, Thursday, or Shabbos mincha, Korin Shlosha, you have three aliyot. So Megillah, you don't have any aliyot. You've got the reader, and that's it. But during the week, Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos afternoon, you have three aliyot. In Pochdim Mehem, we don't have less than three, and Mosifin Elem, and you can't do a Hosafa. You can't say, I've got a Simcha, Shabbos Mincha, can you please call up 14 people and break every two verses? You don't add and you don't detract. In Maftir and Benavi, we don't do a Haftarah from the Navi, Apotech, Vachotem, Betorah, Mavarch, Lefenech, Ara. And the person who does the first Aliyah does the opening Bracha, the person who does the last Aliyah does the closing Bracha, and in between, there are no Brachas. So now you get an Aliyah, you go for Revi, you say Bracha before and after. Initially, the Mishnah says, if you were Shlishi, you didn't get any brachas. If you were Revi, you didn't get any brachas. If you were Rishon, you had the first bracha. If you were Shavi, you had the last bracha. And in between, no brachas at all. So you just kind of stand up, and then you start reading. And we'll see on the second Amud that came to an end as a practice, and everybody started doing a bracha. And the explanation is part of our calculation. How do you get people to pay attention? Well, you've got no enforcement mechanism. How do you keep people interested? And I'd say, at some level, this is something teachers are dealing with now in schools. You know, 50 years ago, people didn't pay attention. You got the cane or something. I don't know, whatever. Right, now you get, or it was enough of a punishment to think you're going to fail and then your life's going to be ruined or whatever it is. Now people are like, kids don't care. They've got their phones and their devices and they've got enough protection or whatever the case is. They're going to be fine. How do I make them pay attention and think this is important, even though I've got no, you know, carrot or stick? So that's to some degree what we're going to be thinking about as we go through this as well. Barosh HaChadashim, about seventh line, and Barosh HaChadashim, first one line is V'chol HaShemot. On Rosh Chodesh and V'chol Moed, Koren Ba'arba, you've got four aliyahs. Ein Pachtim, Ein Menosifin, you don't add, you don't detract. Ein Maftim Ben Avin, there's no Haftarah, Tech V'achodim, B'tovim V'vach L'vanech Ara. And again, the same pattern. The first one has a bracha, the last one has a bracha, no one in between. Zeh HaKlal, this is a general rule. Kon She'esh B'Musaf Ein Yom Tov, any day where there is Musaf, but it's not technically a Yom Tov, meaning Rosh Chodesh or Chol HaMoed. Koren Arba, you have four readers. And you might say, why don't you just say that instead of then saying Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, you get four. General rule, whenever there's a Musaf and not Rosh Chodesh, not Yom Tov, you get four, and that would raise the question as to what's being included. First wide line, B'Yom Tov Chamisha, B'Yom Kippur M'Shisha, you have five aliyahs on Yom Tov, six on Yom Kippur, B'Shabbat Shiva, on Shabbos, you have seven, which suggests that Shabbat is more sacred than Yom Kippur. So when we call Yom Kippur Shabbat Shabbaton, it sounds like it's the supreme holiday. Shabbat seems to be the supreme holiday, and we can talk about that as we go. In Pachtamir Avil Masifim Behen, you don't do less than these. So in Yom Kippur, you don't have less than six. Yom Kippur, you don't have less than five. Shabbat, you don't have less than seven. Aval Masifim Alem, but you can add them. What's the reason you can add on Shabbos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Yom Tov, but you can't on any other days? Guesses, intuitions? Why can you add aliyahs, but you can't during the week?
You have more text, so you
can. Okay. Okay, interesting. So technically it's true, you don't have more text. The explanation that will be given is during the week, people have work. And so this is part of, again, the rabbinic calculation. People can go. They don't have to be here. We want to make this appealing, but we also want to recognize that this shouldn't be shouldered off. How do we balance that? We're going to have three aliyahs, but don't add. People have got work to do. People have got work. They've got to earn a living. And Shabbos and Yom Tov, they're not working, so we can add aliyahs. And it may be frustrating to people, but it's not like I'm going to lose money. But Shabbos Mincha, the assumption is it's going to be close to the end of Shabbos. And if you delay people to the end of Shabbos, as many rabbis are aware, it can be quite problematic. So we don't add at Mincha either. Second wide line, Maftir and Benavi, we do a Haftarah. And as we go through this Perek, we'll be talking about, why is there a Haftarah? Is it just to help with Kiddush clubs? Or what is the reason for the Haftarah in the first place? And there are two possibilities. Hapatech v'chotem, b'torah mevarach levenach areah, and the first one gets a bracha, and the last one gets a bracha, and in between. So we've outlined a couple of points. Again, the Megillah is quite flexible. It can be done sitting or standing. You can have it as a harmony, and if there's a bracha, there's a bracha. If not, not. And then we said, and here are all the other ways that we lane, with three aliyahs, four aliyahs, five aliyahs, six aliyahs, and seven aliyahs, full stop. Today, all we're going to get through is a part attaching to the Megillah. So the Gemara, Tana. It was taught that you can sit or stand reading the Megillah. This is in the yellow now. Marshein kim b'Torah. That sounds like you can't sit or stand if you're laning. And if you're reading the Torah, you have to be on your feet. And this sometimes comes up. Someone reading the Torah laning will sometimes lean on the Amud. And sometimes people get involved and say, don't lean, you've got to be standing. It's not just, you know, there's no seat here and it's easier for people to hear. This is a technical requirement. When you're laning, you have to be standing up. Manai Mili, opening question. How do I know you've got to be standing when you're laning? Why can't you be sitting down? Amri Rabbah says, Dhamma Krat says in the verse when God talks to Moshe, Ata poim Omed Imadi, you are here standing with me. So it sounds like when you're learning Torah or when you're reading Torah, you have to be standing. Vam Rabbi Bo, and Rabbi Bo says, Imale Mikra Kadvi Evshala Omer, and there's a few sentences throughout Chazal, throughout Shas, where I think it's five in total, where one of the Amoraim says, if it wasn't written in the Torah, we would never get away with saying this, but it's in the Torah. It says here, Kaviyachol Avakadosh Baruch Hu Ba'amida. The whole proof of this is God was standing and said, I'm going to teach you, come stand with me. It sounds like God is standing. Which is an interesting, God is showing reverence for what he's communicating, which is a politically astonishing remark that the supreme being has reverence for something outside of him, something that he has produced, which we may talk about next Shabbat afternoon in a different context. So Amar Rabbi Bo, Rabbi Bo says, Minayin l'rav shlo yishev al gabi mitava yishna l'tam midava al gabi karaka. How do I know pedagogically, that a rabbi shouldn't sit on the floor teaching to a group of standing students? How do I know that shouldn't be the arrangement? And sometimes, you know, that is the case. The teachers, you made sure that the teacher's most comfortable sitting on cushions or a good chair, and everybody else is less comfortable. How do I know that shouldn't be the case? Shneimar zit v'atapo amidimadi, that you should come and stand with me. It's understood the teacher should be in a position that shows reverence for their material. And this is a pedagogical calculation as well. How do you show reverence? Is that if you're the conveyor, you shouldn't be sitting or like in a casual way. Now, of course, there are times where people will sit and teach, as the Gemara is about to say. Tan Rabbanan, it was taught in the green. From Moses until Rabban Gamliel, no one would learn Torah if they weren't standing. It was reverent for the material was understood. Mishmei Rabban Gamliel, Yared Cholei La'olam, Rabban Gamliel died. Weakness descended to the world, and at that point, Vayu Lamedim Torah Miyushav, people would learn sitting down, and you know, people couldn't stand it, people wouldn't hack it anymore. This is decline over the ages. People used to stand and they get weak, they can't do it anymore. Behind you did none, And this is what is meant when it's taught in a different Mishnah, Mishmetro Gamliel Batal Kavod HaTorah, that when Gamliel passed away, reverence for the Torah disappeared. And sometimes that's understood, oh, Rabbi Gamliel was a sage, and when he died, people didn't understand real Torah, and it's being interpreted as actually, no, it wasn't just that people didn't have the reverence he had, that nobody learned standing up. People started sitting down and becoming comfortable, which represents a kind of decline in reverence. Now we're going to ask another question about sitting and standing when you're learning. Ktiv Echad Omer, one verse says, for Eshev Bahar, Moshe is describing his time on Har Sinai. He says, Eshev, how do you translate the word Eshev? I will sit. I'll be sitting on the mountain. V'kadav Echad Omer, v'anechi umadeti Bahar. And another one he says, I'm standing. I was standing on the mountain. So he's standing or sitting? Now, these are actually talking about the two different instances, the first Luchot or the second, but the Gemara is assuming he did the same thing both times. How can he say I was sitting and I was standing at the same time? Four answers. Amar Rav, Rav says, Omed Velomed, Yoshev Vishone, he was standing when he learned, and then when he's reviewing the material, he would sit down to be more comfortable. Chanina Amar Lo, Omed Veloshev Veloshoche, it says, actually, he says I was standing and sitting, but he was really doing neither. He was doing something in between, which was kind of in a state of prostration. Which for 40 days and 40 nights, I imagine gets quite uncomfortable. But he says for both occasions, I didn't stand, I didn't sit. I was, you know, I was showing reverence for the material that I was getting. Rabbi Yochanan says, and to some degree, we can understand what's being toyed with mentally here. For example, on Shabbat, we've got Mishabach L'Cholim. Do you sit or stand for Mishabach L'Cholim?
Stand.
Yeah, Yeah, there are some people who sit, some people who stand. It's not a technical rule. It's a mishaberach, and people feel like, oh, I should stand. You know, we're talking about people who are sick. I should show respect. If I say, what about the tefillah l'medinat Yisrael? Should I sit or stand? Yeah, I think intuitively, depending on the community politics, to be like, you better be on your feet. If you go to some communities where they'll say, it's still important to say, but I'm not committed to the political project in the same way, there's going to be less, you know, so you should sit. It's not a big deal. But this is what we're talking about. Should you sit or stand? Does it show reverence or not? And the assumption is, if you want to show that something's important, stand. But also, there seems to be a concession. If people have weakened, and that doesn't mean like they're physically, their constitution is weakened, but if their attachments are such that standing becomes a burden, people should sit and be comfortable. I'd rather you're comfortable and engaged than uncomfortable and alienated. Seems to be the assumption. And until Rabban Gamliel, people didn't have this weakened constitution. They were excited. They were reverence was natural. So again, Moshe was either bowing the whole time or he was only sitting when he was reviewing. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Ein Yeshiva Loshen Agva. When he says, I was sitting, ve'eshev, doesn't mean I was physically sitting. It means I was in place. Sometimes a yeshiva doesn't mean sitting. It means a settled position. Shnemar v'teshu b'kadesh amin rabim, as we talk about the camp of the Jewish people, was in one place for many days. Doesn't mean they were sitting for many days, that they were encamped. Rava Aman Rava finishes with this. Rakot Me'umad, the easy parts of Torah, he was standing. V'kashot B'yushav, and the hard parts, he was sitting. So if anyone ever says, you know, oh, this is a really hard part, I don't say that about the Torah. So Rava seems to think that Moshe felt that way, that there were easy parts. I understand, but they need one for a minion, I understand. Yeah, I'm in the middle of giving a shit, so I'm going to focus on this. If anybody is happy to go and help them make a minion, they're making funny gestures to me. Or he was potentially raising a different finger and he's very angry about something else. Thank you, Hillary. End of the Amud. The Moshe would maybe sit for the difficult parts, because sometimes it's hard to process, and when you're on your feet, I've got a standing desk upstairs, got this thing on Amazon you put on top that you can raise to be on your feet. My father-in-law did one further, and he got a treadmill desk, so you can put your laptop on there while you're walking, and he said he was doing like 8 miles a day doing stuff, which is pretty good. But I mean, if you're doing, you know, entering numbers and figures, I can understand you don't need that much mental attention. If you're, you know, trying to write something that involves creative energy, it's very hard to do that while you're walking or running. Right, that's what very slow I would make it. But standing, but even standing, that at some point I need to sit down so that all my energies are just on thought rather than my body as well. And it's understood that Moshe said when it was very hard, I would sit down. Okay, Kari Echad v'Kari Shnayim Yatsu. If you read the Megillah with a harmony, it's fine. Again, over the page. Tana teaches this, Mashe Enkem v'Torah, which makes it sound like harmony with the Torah does not work. And again, you might think, this would be really engaging. The Torah, you know, it's 45 minutes. People drift. People, you know, bring extra books to read because it's just not engaging. If you had two people do it and it was more dramatic and there was background music and whatever the case is, maybe people were more engaged. And of course, in Orthodoxy, we don't have these mediums available. In Reform context where electricity is not a problem on Shabbos, musical instruments are not a problem on Shabbos, they found all sort of ways they tried. I mean, I say whether it's successful or not, I don't know. But they play with this. How do we make it engaging? But it seems to be here, Chazal is saying, no harmonies with the Torah. You can harmonize with the Megillah, two voices at the same time, but not with the Torah. Why not? Tana Rabbanan, and now we're going to have a proof that this is indeed the implication of the Mishnah, that you shouldn't do that with the Torah. But Torah Echad, Torah Ve'echad Metargim. You should have one reader and one explainer. And this is how it would work. You'd read a verse, and then somebody would explain the verse in Aramaic to the people. And it wasn't always just a direct translation. If you look at Unklus now, there will occasionally be a translation that's a lot longer than the original verse because they would insert explanation. It would be a way of explaining as opposed to just translating. But you shouldn't even have two translating. You shouldn't have two voices at the same time. You say people will hear more, will be clearer. Actually, the sense is that there is complexity and severity around the content of the Torah. There should be one reader and one explainer. Even if it seems less appealing, less engaging, it kind of connotes the atmospherics that this is serious. Uva Navi, what about when you're reading the Navi, Haftorah? Echad Karishnai Mitaragamim, I should have one reader and two translators. You can harmonize at the same time when you're doing the translation. You shouldn't have two readers. So there's a slight leniency. I can't now. They're asking for another one. I don't know if somebody passed out and then they need one more. Say again.
Hillary's a doctor. Someone has that open in back.
Maybe Hillary, is Hillary okay?
What, they need another person from there?
Apparently, I don't know what's going on. Yeah, this is not promising for Pesach. But we'll see how it goes. So in Navi, you can have one reading, two chanting, but as long as you don't have two reading, you can have two translators. When it comes to Halal and the Megillah, Afilo Asara Korin Vasara Metargim, you can have 10 reading and 10 translating at the same time. You can have a harmony, a choir. You can have the Maccabees do the Megillah, probably be expensive, but you can have the Maccabees do the whole Megillah for everybody, no problem. And they could do the whole Halal. And sometimes you have this in davening, people will hire like a group for Shabbos, and you'll have them up there and they're davening together, and it might feel like, you may have one Shliach Tzibur, why is there like four of them singing up there? You know, if it's not the Torah, it sounds like you can do it, it's not a problem. Halal in particular, it says in the Megillah, and this is the explanation. My Tama, what's the reason you can do it with Halal and Megillah? Kivin de Chaviva, since it is beloved, Yahavei da'atahu, people will give their attention, v'shambi, and they'll hear. It seems to, and there are different explanations to what this means, but it seems to be Megillah and Hallel due such affection that people are paying attention. And that means they're going to be able to hear the words, hear the voice, and fulfill their obligation. Torah is a severe document. It's a harsh document. Sometimes it's not dramatically engaging. And to have more than one voice, it just becomes cacophonous. And you're just like, I'm out. You know, I want to make it as, so it seems like we're being more sober about the Torah, but actually it's about making it more accessible. You know, you start having, people reading Parshas Metzora in a harmony, you're like, oh, I'm out. But if you're reading the Megillah, this is a really exciting story. You okay?
Yeah, John is there, and I think they're waiting for one more.
Well, I don't think it's fair for them to take you out if they're still waiting. But, all right. Okay. We'll let it go.
Yeah.
Thank you for your kindness.
Right now they have 10.
Oh, they have 10. In a place where you make a bracha, you can make a bracha, they don't, says the Mishnah. Amar Abaya, I said, hold on a minute, you're telling me making brachas on Megillah isn't required? At which point he says, Lo shanu ele la'achre. We're talking about the after bracha of the Megillah, but the before bracha, of course you'll make a bracha before. Beforehand, it's a mitzvah to make a bracha. Every mitzvah you have to make a bracha before. And the phrase is, over lesiyasen. You have to make a bracha over. What does over mean? Right, before. What does over literally mean?
Over. Passing.
Over, passing. And that's going to say, how do you know over when Rabbi Yehuda and Shmuel said you've got to say over the siyata, it means you've got to be before. How do I know that means before? It means you've got to make a bracha over something. Maybe you should make a bracha over something after it. You know, I'm going to make a blessing over you when you're finished. So we'll ask that question, but he says there obviously has to be a bracha beforehand because we know over lisiyasan. My mashbidahai over lishan da'akto mehu. How do I know that this word over means before, prior to? Amar of Nachman or Yitzhak, we're going to have three potential answers. How do I know it means before? Amar Christ says in the verse, v'yaretz achimatz. This is in the book of Shmuel. Somebody runs to David to give him the update on a war. Achimatz runs, derech hakikar, through the villages, v'ya'avar el hakushi, and he went past, he preceded the Cushite. So we know V'ya'avor means precedent or prior to. Abaya Amar, Mehacha, I got it from a different place. V'hu Avar Lifnehem, this is when Yaakov goes to greet his brother Esav and his whole family's behind him. V'var Lifnehem, he went in front of them. So again, we know it means prior to. V'bayit Eimah Mehacha, or you could say another place, V'yavor Malkam Lifnehem Hashem Barosham, this is in Mika, describing some process of return where the king will go before and God will be at the head. So again, we've got three ways in which the word v'ya'avar means prior to. So when we say over the siyata, it means you've got to make it beforehand. Saying a bracha on the Megillah beforehand is non-negotiable, he says. So while there is flexibility around the Megillah, sitting, standing, harmony, non-harmony, bracha beforehand is necessary because it's a mitzvah. So it doesn't matter how flexible you are. The bracha afterwards, you're right. There are some places that do, some places that don't. Full stop. Lefaneh my mevarach, in the yellow now, first one on the line is lefaneha. So what bracha do you make beforehand? You're saying it's a mitzvah. What is it? Rav Sheshet's mekatriza ikla lakami de Rav Ashi. Rav Sheshet visited Rav Ashi. Yavarech manach. He made the three brachas beforehand, which are resembled by manach. What are those three brachas before the Megillah? Mikra Megillah is the mem. Shasa nisim is the nun. Chechianu is the chet, you know. You could pick a different acronym, like Manash, I guess, but there's some reason to avoid that. So Manach, the brachas he would make. L'acharea, my mevarech, what's the bracha afterwards in the places that they say it? Bracha der Hashem alokeinu melech olam, haravid ruvenu adanit dineinu nokemin nikmatenu v'nefreilenu mitzareinu, v'amashul gamolachai v'navshenu bracha der Hashem v'nefrei yishroem akol sarehem. So that's the bracha that we say afterwards. Rava Amar, Rava says, I disagree with the end part. Instead of saying, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed is, are you, O Lord, Hanifrali Yisrael Mekol Tzareihem, who repays the Jewish people or avenges the Jewish people from all their enemies, Rava said, I don't like that turn of phrase. I prefer Hakel Moshiach, should say, the God who saves. And there's, again, two very different theological or theopolitical outlooks. So we're going to, when we're talking about Jewish redemption, are we saying, thank you, God, for taking vengeance on our enemies? Or we're saying, thank you, God, for saving us. At which point, Amar of Papa, says, Hilkach Nemru Tavayu. Let's say them both. You know, we don't know what to do. They're two legitimate theopolitical views. They've taken root in different communities. So try to bridge them together. So you should say, Baruch Atah Hashem, Hanifrali Yisrael Mekol Tzareihem, Hakel Moshiach. You've taken vengeance on our enemies, and you're the God of salvation. They're not mutually exclusive. There are different foci in these recitations, but we can put them together. As people have observed at this juncture, often Rav Papa gets a lot of attention in one particular Jewish rite, R-I-T-E. What is in a siyum? Rav Papa, Amar Rav Papa, lots of Rav Papa's kids, and people say, what did Rav Papa do? Did he get 10 kids? He get a big mention in the siyum, and it's pointed out that often Rav Papa is a bridge between different views. He'll say this view and that view, so say them both. And this appears in a number of places in Shas where he brings together different views, and the harmonization of different views is what earned him a place. And perhaps it's not out of sync with the theme we're building about trying to make Jewish life and Jewish rights appealing and accommodating. How do we get more people to pay attention? Include different views. And, you know, instead of saying, I don't like your theopolitics, get out. Say, let's find a way to put them together and you can lean in on the emphasis that you prefer. We said that on regular laning days, Monday, Thursday, Shabbos afternoon, three aliyahs. And now we're going to get into the symbolic discussion, which we'll wrap up with. Honey Shlosha, can I give me? Why do you have three aliyahs? And it's a good question. With the Megillah, you have one reader, the bracha at the beginning, and that's it. So why in the Torah do you have three? And again, we're talking about, you want to make this engaging. You want to make this appealing. The Megillah on its own, it's a riveting story. Harmony, people are paying attention. Sitting, people are paying. The Torah it's rough going sometimes. There are hard parts that Moshe had to sit for. How do you get people engaged? So you have three aliyahs. What are the three for? Amar Rav Asi Keneged Tonavim Ketuvim. It is for the three sections of the canon. Rava Amar Keneged Kohen Mavim Yisrael. Rava says actually it aligns analogous to the three units of the people. Ela Hadatani. And now we can say, okay, you've got the symbolism of the three aliyahs. What is the minimum length of laning for any occasion where we're laning Torah? What's the minimum amount of psukim?
Three per aliyah.
Ten. Plus one. So you're going to have 10 minimum, and there's a discussion why it's 10, we'll come to, which is three for two and four for one. So first we're going to say, what is the 10 about? Then we're going to say, and who gets four? It seems like that's quite a good, you know, I got four, I got more bang for my buck. Who gets the four, number one, two, or three? So Rav Shimi, that was taught in the name of Rav Shimi, first medium line. Ein pochtim yupsukim b'veit ha-kneset, we don't do less than 10. Vaydabet olam in a minyan, and in case you're worried, vaydabet olam in a minyan, that counts as one. That is a verse. So you have 10 minimum, and vaydabet includes as one. Hani asar keneged me, what are these 10 for? And if I were to just tell you, pull out of a hat, in Jewish tradition, 10, give me, what does that resemble? Minyan, aser tadibrot. Ten commandments, ten, anything else? Ten Marcos, all good. So that, interesting, that's not offered as a possibility, is why the psukim are there. So Hani Sar Keneged Me, all of these 10 verses, four, second medium. Rav Shubin Levi says, Keneged Asara Bat Lanin Shubabet HaKneset, maybe these 10 correspond to the minimum number of people a city needs for a viable Bet Knesset. And this is something which came up in the first chapter, that you have to have 10 batlanim to be counted as a city, which is kind of a defense of, I don't know if kolal is the word, but there are 10 people who are paid, so they don't have to other occupations, so they're available for minyan round the clock. Minyan go to Shacharis, minyan, mincha, minyan, marv minyan. You don't have to send WhatsApps, you don't have to worry we're going to make it, you're not going to make it. There are 10 people who are paid, so they don't need other employment, so that they can always be a working shul. And again, that's part in the first chapter, we speak about the necessity of hope. It only works if you have the structure in place, so the 10 batlanim. And so that's what the 10 psukim are for, to represent the importance of that structure for a working community. Rav Yosef Amar Keneged Asara Dibros, they say, no, it's to the 10 commandments. You want to know what these minimum verses are? It is the structure that holds us together morally, not the structure that holds us together, I guess, socially. Rav Levi Amar Rav Levi says, Keneged Asara Hilulin Shamadav Sef Tehillim, that's in brackets, it's taken out by the Riff and others, that there are the last five chapters of Tehillim, the word hallelujah appears 10 times. So maybe it's Keneged that. And we said in the last chapter, David's phrasing has a huge influence on Tefillah. We said that the first three brachot, at least, of the Amidah are modeled on some of Tehillim, the order that David speaks about the fathers and God's power and knowledge, and that unfolds, and sanctity rather, and then knowledge, that unfolds following David's lead. And here it seems like maybe he is 10 hallelujahs of why we have 10 psukim. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Keneged Asara Ma'amarot Sheben Nivra Olam says, no, it's actually the 10 utterances that God created the world with. So these are four different ways of understanding what is the minimum binding that holds together a people. Is it the social structures that you need for institutions to function? Is it the moral commitments that you make? Is it the numbers of times that you give praise to God? Is that what holds you together, attachment to God? Or is it the creative utterances that God gave to sustain us in a material cosmos? And now the Gemara say, hold on a minute, Haini Ninhu, this is the second last green medium line. What are these 10 ma'amara? We always talk about 10 ma'amaras God made the world. What are they? Vayomer de Bereshis. Well, it says Vayomer in Bereshis. That's the 10 utterances, at which point the Gemara says, Hani Tisha Havu, I didn't take your word for it, I counted. It says Vayomer only 9 times in the first chapter of Bereshis. So how do you know there were 10? Gemara says, Bereshis Nami Ma'amahu. The first sentence is a Ma'amar. It's true, it doesn't say the word Vayomer, but it's understood. Dichtiv, Bidvar Hashem Shamayim Na'asu V'rech Pivkol Tzva'am, the God created the heavens. Bereshis Baruch Kibbutz Shamayim V'ta'aretz. That's also an utterance, that's the assumption based on this verse in Tehillim. Full stop. So again, minimum of 10, four possibilities what that represents, three aliyahs, two possibilities what that represents. Amar Rava. Rava says, now that we know that you've got to have 10 psukim, there's going to be one guy who gets four and two get three. So who should get which? First yellow medium line. Amarava, Rishon Shekara Dalad Meshubach. If the first one gets four, great. Sheni Shekara Dalad Meshubach. Shishi Shekara Dalad Meshubach. Doesn't matter, the second, third, first, anyone who gets the four, there's always a way to understand it as good. And to some degree, this is again part of the idea. We're trying to make this appealing and engaging, and nobody should feel excluded. And like, if you say, oh, you're going to get Sheni, so you don't get four, so I come second. We want to give as little room as possible for people to feel discriminated against or excluded or unequal. So we're going to build this so everyone's invited, it's accessible, and everything's an honor. And so, and you know, this comes up, will come up in this perek, which is the best aliyah to get on Shabbos? So there's traditions that shishi. What else is a second? Shlishi, there are traditions, because that's the first one available for Yisrael. Shishi is good because it's the parallel with Shlishi, and it's not like, oh, you were the first guy we thought of. We saved it for you. Shvi is good because you're attached to the Maftir, and it, we'll go through each one of them has something that you can say, oh, I got the best Aliyah. And this is kind of built in that everyone should feel like I got something special, and that's intentional at some level. So here...
Is the context of this, though, at this point... They're assuming that the person who gets the Aliyah is the one who's reading it. That's why they call it praiseworthy, because you're reading four sentences. So isn't that more of a Torah than someone just has to learn three? That's how I understood this, that it's praiseworthy, meaning you're doing the
meaning
four.
You'd rather avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, you'd rather just do three. I don't want to learn four psukim. I want to learn three psukim.
Yeah, this is Seth who organizes. Right. Who's laning? He says it is a lot of tirchat laning. He tries to organize a laning. Oh, it's not a tirchat laning.
That's how I understood that. At this point, they're still thinking that the person who got Celia is doing the reading. So it's very praiseworthy. You're reading four things. You're only reading three.
Right. And the assumption is that maybe it's hard, but it's an honor. Like, oh, you want me to lane four? And on the assumption that they're all laning it themselves, the assumption is they know how. And it's going to, when they realize that people can't, that's when it breaks down. So there is a point where that gives way. But you're right, that could be the assumption at the moment. So who should read it? This is the second yellow medium line. Rishon Shekara Dalad Meshubach. We said the first one, if they read four, that's praiseworthy. How do I know? Did none. It was taught in a Mishnah. B'shlosha Kupot, they had three, when they collected the half shekel during the month of Adar as like the annual tax to support what was going on in the Bet Mikdash, they would collect it and they would put it in the room of collections. Where they'd have the money. Then they would have three different kupot that it would be in, and they would divide up the money among the three, and then they would spend the money on sustaining the institution. Now, which pot should you use first? Mm-hmm. You think whatever. But we're going to say, actually, they had three pots, and they labeled them Aleph, Bet, Gimel, so that they could use Aleph first. So it sounds like first come, first serve. And this is true when you're giving a speech and you're thanking people, you always think, like, should I thank the best person first? Should I thank the best person last? And what do you say? You say, first, let me thank you. And if they're the last person, what do you say? Achron, achron, chaviv. The last one, you know, last but not least. And then in the middle, you're kind of like, I don't know. But at least you're not last, and at least you're not first. So that's the question here. Who should do first, second, or third? I mean, even in English, we've developed an idiom. Last but not least, first, what do we say? Save the best for last, first come, first serve. We've got ways to speak about balancing this need. So we would say the first one comes is good as it's taught. But shlosha kubot, shlosha sain, shabahen turamin et alishka. In the three containers that they would have the three sain of money for distribution in the lishka. Haikad v'alem alfet gimel, it was written on them. 1, 2, 3. Leida izamem nitram arishon. So we'd know which one was the first collection. Like kruvim men arishon, so that could be served first. Full stop. Shemitzvah barishon. Now we know that there is a first come, first serve obligation. And therefore, if you're getting the first aliyah, it's a matter of praise. Emsai, how do I know the middle one is good? Now, if you were trying to think about something from Jewish tradition, when we say, oh, being in the middle, that's the best. Yeah. Oh, matzah, you get broken in half if you're in the middle there. Interesting. We're kind of struggling. And this is where it comes to a symbol. Emsai, how do I know the middle one is good? Shakra arba mishubach. How do I know that the middle one gets four? That should be a good thing. Detanya, as it was taught, el mol pnei menorah ya'iru. Facing the middle of the menorah they lit. Melamed shemitzaded pneihem kalpei ner ma'aravi. That the middle candle had all the wicks facing them. So this is evidence that if you're in the middle, you're the best. Some are, you know, yeah, pulling at straws. I want number one. Thank you very much. And the middle one is the one that's facing the Shechina. So if you get Sheni, Again, so far we haven't said this is split between Kohen Levi Yisrael. We're just saying if you have three, who should get them? So the middle one, if you do four, that's also praiseworthy because the middle wick of the menorah gets the most attention and faces the Shekhinah. Va'amar Rabbi Yochanan mikan shem so mishubak. This is where Rabbi Yochanan says so we can see clearly. The middle one is praiseworthy. Va'achron shekra al b'ra mishubak. How do I know the last one? And this is the equivalent of achron achron chaviv. Or something else we would say if you're finishing with somebody. Say, Malin Bakodish Vlo Maridin. You know, we build up to the most sacred. So, Mishum Malin Bakodish Vlo Maridin. So, the last one gets it. That's also a kind of praise. Rav Papa Iklei Lebe Knisha Davi Gova. Rav Papa visited a town where there was a shul in Avi Gova. Vakara Rishon Arba Vashvache. And the first one was the one who got four. And he said, that's good. All right. Sounds like, I don't know if that's a determination. The first one should have four preferably. But Rav Papa, he liked that idea. Rav Papa, Vishrachi Rav Papa, sorry, full stop, and Rav Papa praised it. The next thing, we're going to finish with these two lines. In Pachta Menem Mosivin, and we said when you have a number of aliyahs, you don't add more, you don't add less, and also only the first one says the first bracha, and the last one says the last bracha. So you get Revi on Shabbos, no brachas. You get Sheni during the week, no brachas. That's not contemporary practice. So why is that? Why do we start instituting that everybody gets a bracha before and after? Different potential incentives. This is the answer given by the Gemara. Tana, it was taught. Hapoteach, mevarach lefanev, achodim mevarach lareh. We taught that the first one gets the opening bracha, the last one gets the last bracha. Vahayidna, but nowadays, dekulim mevarach lefanech areha. Nowadays, everybody gets a bracha before and after, which can be difficult for some people, sometimes very nerve-wracking for people to get up and say bracha in front of everybody. When your bar mitzvah, I at least growing up in England, one of the key things they were showing bar mitzvah boys, laning is important, but let's learn how to do the bracha. And there was even a tune that you would sing to the bracha to make sure you get it right. What's the reason everyone has a bracha? Not so that everybody should feel important. Hainu tama, this is the reason. Tetakina Rabbana, the rabbis instituted it. Gezeira mishum ha-nichnasim u'mishum ha-yotzim. It was a decree for the people who go in and the people who come out. Meaning, let's say they've started Rishon, and I go out for a minute because I need, something's come up. So I've heard the opening bracha, and I've left. What might I think? I might think there's no bracha at the end. And then next time I'm in shul, and they call someone up for Shvi, and he starts saying a bracha. Oh, there's no end bracha. I was in shul yesterday, and I know that I left, but I just assumed there wasn't one, and on that basis, this is a mess. So yeah, every aliyah, there's a bracha. And there's an assumption people are going to sit for an aliyah, but people might go out after an aliyah. And what happens if somebody's late, and they arrive for in the middle of Shvi, and they didn't hear whether there was a bracha before or afterwards, before, and then they hear a bracha at the end. They might think there's no bracha at the beginning. So this is, again, this is a quite a far-fetched worry that people are going to use deductive logic without basis to assume, I wasn't there, it didn't happen, and they're going to be confusion. And the assumption is people are going to be there for an aliyah, but they're not going to be there for the whole laning. And therefore, every aliyah, we institute a bracha before and after. And this concern, again, speaks to this theme. The rabbis are assuming, you know, if you had a problem with Nichnasim and Yotzim, what's one solution?
Don't let them leave.
Yeah, lock the door. Like, don't come in and don't leave, and that's it. And you don't think that's a possibility?
No, the trouble with this is it's presuming that someone only goes to shul once in their life.
This is, right, this is, I mean...
Yeah, this is like taking a sledgehammer to a flea. I mean, it's like a ridiculous...
Incredibly effective.
No, on the other
hand. Oh, I see. Over the top?
I mean, you're instituting where now where you could get away with two brachas, now you have to do seven for that one out of ten person who goes in.
One out of ten, because it's makes someone no sense. Who has one experience in shul in his life.
And
it sounds like reverse engineering. We already had a minhag that we do seven, so we're trying to figure out why. And it just seems like a lame excuse, to be honest with you.
That time people went in and out much more than they do today.
Right, maybe they had a kiddush. Right, they had a kiddush club for every aliyah, maybe. Right, so I think we may be again. I'm not a historian. It may be that we project backwards that people had minyanim. They came. There was a minyan every day, and they came on Shabbos. And it was a lot looser. You know, maybe you did go to shul once a year. Growing up in England, I don't know how many of you had this. You know, back in the day, I understand America was a little different. The people would come to shul 3 times a year. People come to shul for Yom Kippur, and that was it. So there are people who are coming once a year. And Chazal, you'd still say, they're making a gzerah for that guy who comes once a year? How about we think about the core, who's there every day? And, you know, if they get a misimpression, someone should say, maybe you shouldn't build your life impressions off one day. You should come more often. And what Chazal is saying is, we are willing to make a decree, increase the number of brachot. It slows things down, but we're going to do it for that guy who comes once a year. Maybe historically it was more than one guy, but it was a whole group. But you're right, the far-fetchedness of this hammer, sledgehammer to the flea seems to be Chazal saying how far we're willing to go to make sure that shul is accommodating the public, to make sure there is no misimpression. We're responsible for what people think. We're not in a position to start enforcing things and taking for granted that people remember and know. We're curating how people understand. This is them doing what I mean. Someone might think that I was being ridiculous this last week, promising my daughter that if she drinks that medicine, she can watch a video. If she drinks that medicine, I'll give her 3 Tic Tacs. She'll get to pick which color. So just make her tell her she'll be sick if she doesn't drink it. I tried that and it doesn't work. There's a point. And I could say, if you don't drink it, you know, we'll go back to, you know, the old fashioned way, you know, get out the belt or whatever the case is. And Chazal in a position where they say, look, we have a choice now. We don't have the machinery of government. And even if we did, I don't know what we would do with it, but we don't. How do you keep a people together when they could walk away very easily? And throughout the medieval period, it was easy. It was advantageous to walk away from Judaism. Of course, there were then suspicions that bled on to you're a new Christian, so we don't really trust you. But the pressures to leave were immense. And before it became that much persecution, the ability to leave was easy. And Chazal is saying, how do we make Jewish life accessible, accommodating, inclusive, without giving up on the severity and the sobriety of what we're doing? And when it comes to the Megillah, we've got a bit more flexibility because it's, you know, it's a story. People are here, you know, Purim night, lots of people are here. Is there more of an obligation to hear the Megillah than there is to hear the Torah read every week? It's debatable, but it draws crowds because it's exciting. How do we keep the Torah with its sobriety, but also accessible? One reader, standing, give a sense of gravitas. But we're willing to institute brachas because people do come in and go out. And this isn't to say we should just, you know, accept that that's what it is and not find ways to encourage more sobriety and more attention and more engagement. But it does mean that around the edges, Chazal seem to be leaning in. How can we make shul more accommodating and more inclusive so that the people who are wandering in and out don't get the wrong impression?
We'll struggle with those issues today.
Indeed. We don't have the force of government. We don't have the machinery. And the different communities take different view. I've heard there's one member of staff at YU who goes around advising boards and shuls when they're trying to navigate. And you know, I don't know how much surveys or statistics have been done, but they said there is often a correlation. The more signs you see up in a shul, the more decline you can predict for community. So the more it says no talking or don't come in, he says he walks into a shul, sees that, and he thinks, I can tell the shul is in decline. Not because it's like a panic, but because when it goes together. People are like, why would I come to a place where they berate me? Now, some people, you know, are gluttons for punishment. And, they, you know, you hear stories. There's a rabbi who also happens to be on staff at YU, and it was known that if he were talking in shul, he would, like, stop, and he would go, and, like, point at the person talking. And maybe they felt like, oh, the rabbi pointed at me. This is exciting. And, like, and you know, if it's an esteemed rabbinic figure, they gave you attention. I can see why some people might like that. And there are some shuls where, like, the culture is understood. We don't talk here. And you're not going to be here otherwise. And they said, we're fine with that. There are other shuls. There's a talking shul down the block. And we're a shul with it. And it's complicated how you form a judgment about this. Because you might shrink your membership. You might put them off of Judaism. And you've got responsibility for their lives and their souls. And maybe the longevity of your own community and the Jewish people. And here Chazal are kind of writing a rubric, not for a shul, but for a civilization. How do we sustain a people? And it's true, there may be individual shuls that say we can cope if they leave and go to the shul down the road. But if you're writing a script, and this is true, and it's a difficulty, for example, the United Synagogue in England, is like the Orthodox Union, but far more ingrained in the synagogues. They've got 50 shuls, the United Synagogue Shul, this under the chief rabbi's aegis. When he writes a policy, it's not a policy for the Young Israel Jamaica States, it's a policy for the Young Israels nationally. How do you write a policy that's inclusive? And this came up particularly during COVID. During COVID, every shul had their own policy. They said, what works for our community? I know them. In England, the chief rabbi wrote a policy for 50 shuls that are made up in different ways. And it's led to a lot of disenfranchisement after time. People are like, I want a different shul that's more culturally monolithic. I don't want this kind of inclusive, you know, fluffy stuff. I want to feel like and there's been what's called the shtiebelization, which you've got here as well. People are like, I want to feel like I'm surrounded by people I know, not that like there are policies for the whole community. It feels like inclusive. I want to be like, have my own way. That's the weakness. But Chazal are trying to do that. They're speaking for a whole people. How do we design life so it's inclusive while there's room for some flexibility in each shul? Okay, well, and there we'll pick up with the full lines up from the bottom after Pesach. I think the first Sunday after Pesach we will meet. I can't remember when Yom Tov is. Monday, Tuesday, the last days?
Yes.
All right, so we can probably meet that Sunday. The week after that, I think it's the 12th, where we'll be skipping. And then we'll, please God, be back.
Israel,
yeah, there's we'll be in Israel. And then the week after that, please God, we'll pick up again. Thank you. Thank you.